could only hear it in the painful hours of the morning. Way off in the distance, the sound you'd hear when you were standing on the porch in your pajamas, rubbing your hands together in the cold, and hearing that sound that makes you dream of big things, the sound of the world turning on its axis. It rings in my ears even now, a low, layered drone that drifts like clouds, calling me to stand outside at absurd hours and listen. I eventually found the sound's source in the concrete roadbeds of the nearby interstate, in the music played by endless tires churning endless miles on their way somewhere else. Sojourn in special education as a flailing, unprepared school system resorted to what amounted to protective custody. My class was populated entirely by kids much older than me. Kids who would have been perfect candidates for a John Waters cattle call. My favorite was Tracy Weeks, a girl from down the dirt road whose sunny demeanor always seemed at odds with her less than easy home life. She had slightly crossed eyes in those days and always seemed to be looking at someone just behind you and to the left. And you always felt like someone was following her, someone that Tracy knew well enough to talk to, yelling, "Hey, I'm talking to you!" To be her friend was to live in her off-balance world, and naturally I had a non-binding, a non-sexual crush on her that lasted until I asked her what the word hump meant on one seemingly average day in the third grade. It's difficult to describe exactly what she did to illustrate this definition, except to say that it involved a desk, some terribly upsetting contortions, and disturbing moans of, "Oh, baby, oh, yeah, baby, oh, baby, yeah, baby," rendered in a ragged monotone that I think she thought sounded pretty sexy. Needless to say, I spent the rest of the third grade with my fingers always crossed, hoping that no one would try to hump me anytime soon. Okay, now Tracy's prized possession was the stuff of childhood fever dreams, an Olympic-sized, all-singing, all-bouncing green canvas trampoline that stood in her wee backyard like an altar for sky worship. She was sharp as a tack when it came to managing that trampoline, and you didn't even get a look at it from a distance if you weren't on her A-list. I was lucky. I was among the elite, probably for the only time in my entire school career. Now, there was only one catch. To trip the tight elastic, you had to go visit Tracy's dad in his room. And for some reason, he was much older than everyone else's dad. Much, much older. In his 70s, I think. And a permanent resident of a shiny industrial-grade hospital bed with oxygen tanks and tubes and wires everywhere. Visiting him was terrifying, but I was never sure exactly why. To get through it, you had to visualize yourself in midair, laughing and flying and defying gravity, even as his small, grim room and the smell of hospital antiseptic worked as the catalyst for a nearly paralyzing case of the willies. He turned to you and Tracy, looking slack and wasted in his mechanical bed. Smile an incomplete smile of missing and mismatched teeth, and rasp out some simple questions. Have I met your boyfriend before I show you? Yes, Daddy. You want to go to school? Yes, Daddy.
Does your boyfriend like to play sports?
Yes, Daddy. I'm asking the boy, sure. Sports are okay, I'd answer, lying and feeling awkward doing it.
Can you all push me over the window, sugar?
Yes, Daddy. And he'd roll his bed over to the window and start to leave, and his last question was always the same. For some reason, Tracy always said the same thing every day. It's Tuesday, Daddy. Then we'd step down the creaky back steps and out to the yard, where the sun burned and the trampoline practically glowed. And you'd feel the aluminum tubes of the frame hot in your paws as you climbed up and onto the green canvas and built up momentum until you were flying, just flying. Lost in the sky, and in the smell of that perfect afternoon, and in the sound of yourself laughing, trying stupid tricks and clever acrobatics, and trying not to stare at that face in the window. It was impossible not to wonder if you were actually standing still, with the whole world in motion around you. Seem quite so lonely, because it was the face of a man who is riding a world in motion, and we were calm at its churning center, suspended there in someone else's frantic dreams. Okay, for a while, I was pretty sure I had magical powers. I noticed that the clocks on the classroom walls would suddenly stop, then run backwards, or suddenly flick forwards a few minutes in one quick snap. And when I asked my teachers if they'd seen it happening, they all seemed to roll their eyes and make some sort of mental note about it, which only reinforced my belief that there was either something wrong with me or with the rest of the universe. Now, by the clumsy mathematics of adolescent logic, I'd worked out that I had the power to manipulate time. And only I could see it happening. Now, I clearly didn't have it under precise control, almost as if it were an unconscious function of the lower parts of my brain, like breathing or digestion, or being inexplicably terrified of the church organist. Still, I was manipulating the space-time continuum, and that was surely a hell of a feat, even if it was a mostly accidental one. Now, I started to feel like a superhero of sorts, and my life suddenly made some sort of sense, for the first time ever. Now, when in the course of many, many front office visits, I confessed to the vice principal that I'd been learning the art of changing the flow of time, and after saying that I was at least learning something, she showed me a panel in the office called the Master Clock Control and explained how it kept all the clocks in the school accurate by periodically adjusting them via remote control. And suddenly I felt like a temporal Icarus falling out of control, flapping useless wings made of misconceptions, falling helplessly forward, headed for the end of the world. Okay, it was a time of joy whenever we got a new large appliance. because I'd always be given the box as a matter of tradition, and I'd extract weeks of play from the thing before the cardboard was so battered that it was soft as cloth. Now, when autumn came, I'd combine my box fetish with my love of leaf piles, carefully raking leaves around a box until it was well hidden. And then I'd crawl through the leaves and into my ephemeral fortress of solitude to sit and think and wonder if anyone would come looking for me. Now, one day, I got the idea to take an empty cereal box, wrap it in gray construction paper, and carefully write on it in my best handwriting, Joseph B. Wall, born May 16th, 1968, died October 23rd, 1977. I ceremoniously placed it at the head of my leaf pile and solemnly crawled through the leaves and into my premature grave. Now, I sat there for a long time, smirking to myself at the cleverness of my concept, reading all popular mechanics magazines with a flashlight, and nibbling on stale granola bars that I'd been stockpiling for just such an occasion. After the better part of the afternoon went by without ceremony, I started to feel a bit insulted, because I'd heard no wailing or gnashing of teeth at my lonely gravesite, no tortured breast beating, no anguished sobs, no nothing. I lay there fuming in my grave, determined to stay dead until someone came looking for me. But quickly tiring of my dark and itchy afterlife, and considering the prospect of reincarnating into a life in which someone might wonder why I died so very, very young. Now, curled up in my box, I pondered the big questions. The questions that make your head ache, like, why are we conscious? And what was there before the universe existed? And if the Earth is spinning around the sun at 33,000 miles an hour, what's keeping us from flying off? Now, I was sufficiently Taoist in my youth to consider the first two questions as standard issue imponderables, but the last always troubled me, and sometimes I'd get an overwhelming urge to drop to the ground and hang onto the grass, lest I be flung into the void. Eventually, I heard my sister and her friend Paula walking somewhere nearby and talking. "What's that thing there?" asked Paula. My sister made a little amused noise. "Seems to be a gravestone," she answered matter-of-factly. "Apparently, Joe's dead." I heard their footsteps in the leaves coming closer and unsuccessfully stifled a giggle in my box. The footfalls came and went, and the sound of teenage conversation drifted into the background noise of an autumn afternoon. It's too heavy to remember. Now, when the close was clear, I crawled out through the leaves and found a small bouquet of black-eyed Susans propped up against my homemade headstone, and I felt a profound sense of accomplishment and started planning my next premature demise. Even as I headed for the house in search of something to eat. After browsing through my favorite 4-H club exhibit, the prize-winning baked goods in glass cases that always turned into extraterrestrial moldscapes of blue and white fur bursting out of apple dumplings and blue ribbon shoe fly pies in the waning days of the fair. I got lost and wandered for what seemed like hours, drifting through tents showcasing tractors and maxi-tilting easy-clean three-pane vinyl replacement windows and more crocheted toilet paper roll cozies than a person of my age could reasonably hope to count. I wandered into the tent of the local survivalist association and was browsing through piles of literature detailing how to survive the coming apocalypse when an older man in olive drab beckoned to me. "You look like a smart boy," he said in a friendly voice. I smiled, clutching a mimeographed booklet of bomb shelter plans. "Are you ready to help shape the bold world of the future?" I instantly imagined myself living in the bold world of the future, wearing a smart white jumpsuit with orange pinstriping, lounging on a shaggy brown fun fur beanbag, listening to music from outer space, and lazily watching my robot vacuum the lime green shag rug. "Yeah, I'm ready." "Okay, first, you gotta survive the nuclear exchange. And these will help you do that. Then," he continued, shifting on his folding chair to light a cigarette and hand me some books and brochures, "then you gotta be ready for the strife." "The strife?" "Once the Fed's hard targets go down, it's going to be a free-for-all until we get all the survival cells linked up into a quasi-anarchist confederacy. You got to be ready to defend your family from the looters and the neo-federalists, son." Now, my eyes glazed over at this point, but I was alarmed at the prospect of being alarmed by neo-anything. So I listened to the rest of his pitch, most of which went right over my head. Phrases like trilateral commission and race war and neo-syndicalist didn't ring any bells, so I just smiled at what I hoped were the right points and strolled out of the tent 20 minutes later with an armload of free reading material and a head full of ideas that would drive my parents totally insane for years to come. "Remember to get starved on a temporary bomb shelter as soon as you get home," the man said, following me to the tent's exit and waving goodbye like an old friend. "I will, thanks." Now, it may sound odd to say so, but my first lover was a sturdy 52-year-old woman named Gladys, who wore cat's-eye glasses and far too much lipstick as she served us tater tots and Salisbury steak in the elementary school cafeteria. Whenever the scourge of head lice made the rounds, she'd get drafted to help with the lice checks, and once I'd felt her doughy hand delicately kneading my scalp in a way that made waves of goosebumps wash over me like the insane joy of running down the stairs on Christmas morning, I schemed to get into her chair by any means necessary. "I love you, I love you." Now, I'd start out by scratching my head all day when lice checks were scheduled, and complaining to my teacher about a recurring itch that just wouldn't go away, and claiming to have spent long hours playing with the kids from down the dirt road, which for some reason seemed to qualify you for the most intensive examination of all, and by the most skilled examiner, my sweet and saucy Gladys. "Ah, yes," I'd claim. "Tracy Weeks is my very best friend. I play with her all the time." And then I'd enjoy that soul-warming lice check without shame, rationalizing my exaggeration as a fair exchange for living in under the constant threat of suddenly being hurled into space by a whirling, uncontrollable world. It all came came to an end when Wayne Atherholt overheard me claiming to be Tracy's best friend and spun it into a wedding announcement, trumpeting around the school that I was friends with an actual retard, for God's sakes. And there was nothing to be done but to deny everything, even at the cost of trading my affair with Gladys for the cursory and unfulfilling cranial assault of the gym teacher's nicotine-stained, rough, and graceless fingers, which I knew I deserved, even then. Now, for reasons that seemed rational at the time, I was always convinced that the end of civilization as we know it was always just around the corner. I stayed constantly on the lookout for temporary shelter in case I saw Soviet missiles in the sky. At recess, my safe place was in the drain culvert that came out at the end of the playground. In the 70s, they were testing domestic routes for the Concorde, and every time it flew over, I was sure doomsday was here. I'd race down to the culvert and wriggle in, doing a fast and painful military crawl through the concrete pipe until I was just under the blacktop, hearing the attenuated thumps of Foursquare Games through the asphalt and dirt overhead. I'd lie there waiting for the apocalypse and listening to the sounds of recess filtering through and thinking about the bold world of the future, until my teacher appeared at the end of the culvert shouting for me to get out of there.
Mr. Wall, if you don't get out of that culvert right this second, I will make you regret.
Okay, so I come out reluctantly, still expecting the atomic flash at any moment. And when I found myself standing there, breathing my teacher's astonishingly bad breath, and trying desperately to make time run backwards, I hoped that she'd at least live long enough to regret causing my horrible death and the strife of an anarchist post-apocalyptic civilization created without the wisdom I'd gained from my many months spent poring over survivalist textbooks. And every time the world didn't end and I'd be left alone at the end of the playground, looking dazed and lost, and as if I was going to cry at any moment. And Tracy would see me there and come over asking, "Hey, you want to come over and jump on my trampoline after school?" Days are with me like the sound of the world turning. And sometimes I feel like a trampoline spectator, watching it all from a window, riding a world in constant motion.